the last appeal and also in this one is in some ways can be stated in familiar terms that this Court has addressed before, and that is, what does it mean to enter judgment? But in the context of this case, there's another question that arises, and that is, can entry of judgment be implied? Now, as to the first point, I think that the Court's decision in Harder, which was discussed at length in the previous case, answers the question, I think, reasonably well. And the reason for that is that in looking at the words of the orders that were at issue in that case, the words such as the complaint is dismissed or judgment is entered, and then there was a notice of entry of judgment in Harder, those were all facts that were present in that particular case, and I think provides a great deal of guidance and insight into the Court's holding in that case. But the question here really is can a judgment be implied as the Court of Appeals decided in this particular case? And I say that because the words that were at issue in the Harder case and in prior cases, the Frederick case discussed previously, are not present in the order in this particular action. And so what, in essence, the Court of Appeals did in that case is that they implied that the order was a judgment. They implied language that did not exist in that order, which is the complaint is dismissed, judgment is entered on the verdict.
Well, let me ask you, I've got the order denying post-trial motions in front of me, and I just, now your position is that this is not sufficient. Your position, if I understand it, is that it's the judgment of June 14th, not the May 24th document. So
that's correct.
Let me just ask you, looking at this and going through it, what substantive issue remained after the litigation? Because that, if you're talking about Harder, we're talking about what substantive issue. So what remained?
Dismissing the case, entering judgment upon the verdict, disposing of the case.
But, when we talk about substantive issue, I'm just looking, this was basically about the motions after verdict.
Correct.
So you had number one, there was a denial of a motion, and then number two, it says the Court finds the record is replete with abundant credible evidence to support the jury's verdict. So we're talking about jury verdict. The statutory grounds to change answers are therefore not present. So my question is, does this resolve all of the substantive issues that talks? So you're saying it does not.
It does
because
not.
You need the dismissal.
Exactly.
And there were no, I just want to say there are no, he talks about there are no errors of trial. He talks about the new trial, a motion for new trial is denied. So the Court finds that in the event errors did occur, any errors would constitute harmless error. So my question, and you're answering it, is no, that this is not enough. You need that other document.
That's correct. And I think that that answer is actually provided in, when you look at the 805.14 sub 5A, which was one of the statutes that was relied upon on the motions after verdict, I think that that particular statute provides the answer to your question, Justice Wilcox. That particular statute is entitled Motion for Judgment, and it says a motion for judgment on the verdict is not required. If no motion after verdict is filed within the time period specified in 805.16, judgment shall be entered on the verdict at the expiration thereof. If a motion after verdict is timely filed, motion on the verdict shall be entered upon the denial of that motion. So that statute implies that judgment, it commands action. It commands that there be an entry of judgment, and it recognizes that there's a difference between denying the motion and entering judgment. That fact is reinforced in 805.16 sub 3. And that particular statute says that if within 90 days after the verdict is rendered, the court does not decide a motion after verdict on the record, or the judge or the clerk at the judge's written direction does not sign an order deciding the motion, the motion is considered denied, and judgment shall be entered on the verdict. Now, if denial of the motion was the same thing as entering judgment, wouldn't it say, and judgment shall be considered entered? But it doesn't. It says judgment shall be entered on the verdict. And so both of these statutes, I think, address the question that you raised, Justice Wilcox, which is that there has to be, in the context of this situation on motions after verdict, that a denial of the motion itself is not entry of judgment on the verdict. Because that is contemplated as a separate act under both of these statutes. And I think that
may be true. But under Harder, which is quoted by the Court of Appeals, Harder says, when a circuit court enters an order or a judgment, and this document is labeled order, I know labels don't always count, but it sure helps, right?
Right.
When a circuit court enters an order that decides all substantive issues as to one or more parties, and Justice Wilcox read you only one or two, maybe three of, I think, the 12 items, all of which say you lose. The verdict is going to stand. There was an error. It was harmless. It's just the verdict stands. So when a circuit court enters an order, and that was an order, that decides all substantive issues, which it did as to one of the parties, decides, not disposes, decides all, as a matter of law, the circuit court intended that to be the final document, not for all purposes, but for purposes of appeal. That's what Harder says.
Right.
Harder deems that if the circuit court enters an order that decides all substantive issues to one or more parties, then that is, for purposes of appeal, the final document, notwithstanding subsequent actions or the label. So I might agree with you that 805.14 says you should have a judgment.
It says shall.
Yeah, okay, I'll give it to you. Shall have a judgment. But for purposes of appeal, this looks final. If you apply Harder literally, this order fits Harder. Why doesn't it fit Harder?
Well, I think if you look at Harder, if you look at the order that was at issue at Harder, it clearly said dismiss.
I agree with you. Facts are different. But that's one of the holdings in Harder. And that's what the Court of Appeals applied. Pages.
I think there's two, I have two thoughts on that. One is, and I kind of hearken back to my first year in law school, civil procedure with Professor John Conway, and basically
That may not be a good example for some of us on the court, because we had John Conway and great professor, but we were somewhat, I'll speak for myself, somewhat confused when we came out of that court.
Well, the question,
oh, really? I got my best grade in that class.
Oh, really? Yeah.
The question isn't whether the students were confused. The question is whether John Conway was confused.
Well, the one thing that I do remember is he drilled into us is that pleadings come in pairs, and that there was balance to things that happen in a lawsuit, and an action is commenced with the filing of a summons and complaint, and therefore at some point it has to be dismissed, and you do that with a judgment or with words of dismissal or granting. Or entering judgment on a verdict. And it seems to me that that is what is required in order to dispose of a case.
Let me follow up the Chief's question. I find this case more troubling than the last one, so I want to hone in on what's really bothering me. Let's assume, as the Chief did with her question, this, under Harder, this order, we didn't have an order in the last case. We had a memorandum decision. In this case, we've got an order. Disposes of, it appears to dispose of the issues in the case. You have a subsequent judgment that comes out. If the court were to construe that this order, as the Court of Appeals did, were final under Harder, my question is, could you, as part of your appeal, appeal the judgment?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, I'm looking at a case from 1940, Homeowners versus Apera. And it would seem to suggest that for purposes of appeal, this in fact might be a final document. But it would also seem to suggest that you might not be able to relate it back and appeal from the judgment because there is no judgment. And so that's my concern about whether or not you can, even if this is a final document for purposes of appeal, whether you can only appeal the post-verdict motions decision and order, or whether you can go back and relate it back to the actual judgment and appeal from the judgment, because that might make a difference in what we do with this case.
Well, I mean, isn't the language in 803, I mean, doesn't that kind of give us a guide there? In other words, it disposes of the entire matter in the action. It's not a question of whether it disposes of the particular issue that is in front of the court. And I think this sort of gets to Justice Prosser's question in the prior case, which is what's the difference between, I'm not sure if I'm interpreting it correctly, but what's the difference between decide and
entire.
Dispose,
right. And it seems to me that you decide motions. They are pieces of the puzzle of the case. But you dispose of cases. And you dispose of cases by putting in language that says, judgment is entered, case dismissed. Language like that, so that it is clear that this is it, whatever it is, and that at that point, all the parties, anyone who's aggrieved by that, is on notice that that is when their clock starts running for filing their notice of appeal.
Well, that's why apparently the Court of Appeals relied on the language decides rather than disposes in Harder. Because Harder uses both.
The statute talks about disposes. And I think that particularly in the context of motions after verdict, where I think the statute is clear that deciding the motions is not the same as entering judgment. It doesn't say judgment shall be considered to be entered. Or is deemed entered, things of that nature. It actually commands something, enter judgment, that it requires a final disposition of the case.
Well, should we correct Harder and say we should have used the word dispose all the time rather than decide?
I don't think that the words are interchangeable.
I'm assuming that you don't.
Right.
So.
And to the extent that Harder creates confusion, then certainly this case and the preceding case provide the court with an opportunity to clear that up.
Well, was the trial court's quote, order, unquote, on the motion after verdict, was that entered? Was it in, was it filed with the court?
It was filed with the court, correct.
Counsel, you make reference earlier that in the context of this case, which is motions after judgment, jury case, motions after judgment, that 805.14 says there shall be a judgment. And you emphasize that, shall be a judgment in motions after verdict. So I want to look at that judgment. Now, my knowledge of judgments leads me to believe that you have three types of judgments. I mean, I know you have declaratory and summary, but for purposes of this kind of analysis, you have a final judgment, you have an interlocutory judgment, or you have a partial judgment. Final, interlocutory, or partial. And that's what our judicial bench book also says. Those are the kind of, that's what you're dealing with. So I'm looking at this judgment dated June 14th of 2005. And unless it's a nullity, I think it has to be a final, an interlocutory, or a partial. What is this judgment signed June 14th of 2005?
And this is the judgment that you're referring to that was provided by, that signed on June 14th. This is a final judgment.
Why isn't it something other than a final judgment?
Because it says the claims of the plaintiff are dismissed with prejudice. I mean, I don't know how, I mean, that pretty much takes care of it. And obviously that language is the language that, you know, I mean, the reason for this was because that language was not in the order, the preceding order, denying the motions after verdict. So this made clear, 2 weeks later, this made clear that the case was over so that a notice of appeal would be appropriate.
I think that you're also relying, I assume, on the Stenman case, which says that you cannot appeal from. In other words, as I understand it, you cannot appeal from the type of order that was drafted. The order drafted post-trial motions. The Stenman case is an old case,
right.
But as I recall, it has not been overruled. And I assume you relied on that case.
Clearly, and I think that the statute, I mean, I think that the statute embodies that concept that a ruling on motions after verdict is a ruling. It is a decision on a motion. It is not a judgment. And that to dispose of the entire matter as to a party, you require language like the language that existed in the order in Harder and Frederick and the other cases that have been discussed that clearly say this case is dismissed, judgment is entered on the verdict. I think the other important the other important feature to both of these cases, and it was alluded to in the first argument, is that, you know, the rules are not supposed to be traps for the unwary. The right to appeal is embodied in the Wisconsin Constitution, and the rules governing appeal should be a roadmap and a guide for practitioners, not traps. And I think that the way that the Court of Appeals in this case interpreted Harder, interpreted as a trap, as a limitation on the right to appeal, rather than a liberal construction of those rules, as this Court has has said in the past is warranted. I think that the prior cases, in looking at all of those cases, Radoff, Harder, City of Janesville case, Frederick, that the lesson to practitioners who see those cases, see the language in the orders that were at issue there, recognize that the court's decisions in those cases were addressed to those kinds of orders, and that consequently it's that kind of language that practitioners look to and expect when they're looking for the final order. And that is why, to the extent that there is confusion, and no doubt there is, when something comes in that of the sort of the order that we're dealing with in this case, where that language is not there, then, as occurred in this case, a final judgment was prepared for the judge's signature. And picking up on the instruction in Harder, where the court said that it's the aggrieved who has to be most sensitive to this, you know, the lesson there is if you're in doubt, you better get something to the court that erases that doubt. And that's exactly what happened here. This is not a situation, unlike Harder, where months and months passed before the notice of appeal was taken. I mean, this notice of appeal, if we're looking at the date of the order, was late by a very short amount of time. And so this is not a situation where the court needs to exercise its gatekeeping function to keep out appeals that are long overdue.
Well, what rule would you have the court adopt? And I don't mean rulemaking. What interpretation of the statute would you have the court adopt that would have helped you and would help future lawyers? I mean, Harder, you don't think was good enough because they applied the exact language of Harder here and came up against you. And you think that violates another set of statutes about a judgment required. So what should this court write? If we held your way, what should the court write?
I think that the correct decision, the decision that will assist practitioners, is that there must be language in the concluding document that encompasses language like the language that was present in the order that was at issue in Harder. Case is dismissed. Judgment is entered on the verdict. Language like that, so that there is no doubt amongst the people who are looking at these kinds of things to try to figure out exactly when their time for appeal runs, whether the document in front of them is the final document, disposes of everything, that it'll be clear. And that I like the Chief's suggestion in the prior case that if that language is not there, it would be construed against the respondent. I think that that's a reasonable proposal. I think that that is something that everyone, that will assist practitioners in understanding exactly when.
Now, in the previous case, and I think this was pointed out, that clearly the person asking for the finality filed an entry of judgment. So that is pointed out by, I think, the Chief. That was clear. There was only a 3-day window, but that was intended. One party felt that way, and that was a signal that I'm intending to for this to be a final. It, in my opinion, it gets a little more murky when you're You're talking, there's no entry filed, there's no entry, and now you've got the 90 days, and you're up against that. But you're suggesting what we call magic words. Something has to be in there saying either this is dismissed, it's a final judgment, to put everybody on notice.
I think
regardless of the substance.
If you're going to dispose of a case, if you're going to enter judgment on the verdict, if you're going to dismiss it, whatever the case is, if you're the judge, if you're the moving party, and you expect that a determination is going to conclude the case, it just seems reasonable to include language like that in the final order so that there is no need for interpretation. And if it's a magic words, I mean, I think that there can be a variety of ways of saying it, but I think everybody understands cases dismissed with prejudice, judgment is entered on the verdict. Those are certainly things that all of us understand. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Reinhart, representing the River Bank.
Good morning. My name is Pete Reinhart. I represent the Riverbank in this case. I perhaps have a different perspective than Mr. Sullivan about the issue in this case. I believe this case is about what does the holding of Harder really mean? That is, what does it mean to decide all substantive issues? Specifically, is certain language, such as language of dismissal, required under Harder? The Court of Appeals raised this issue sua sponte. I'm here before you today as an advocate for the Riverbank. I'm also here before you as a lawyer concerned about the clarity in the law. And in that vein, as Mr. Iden said, I will offer you perhaps my prospective comments about what I think this court ought to do for future cases. But in my role as an advocate, I will talk about what I think Harder means and what a strict interpretation of Harder means.
You think that Harder, and of course we all joined Harder, we're all seven of us, we're all to blame for it, or we'll take the accolades. But in any event, in Harder, you had this language, but I asked opposing counsel about the Steinman case. I think it's Steinman versus Breyfogle, which says that a proposition, and this is it, that denial of a motion for new trial is not an appealable order or judgment.
Is that the
1933 case?
33
yes.
Case.
It's old.
My response would be that the statutory rules trump that antiquated case in terms of how you determine what judgment or order should be appealed from.
Right.
This is a different context, obviously, than the previous case because we're more or less on the back end as opposed to the front end. And just procedurally, this case was tried to a jury, and the jury found in favor of Riverbank on all of the claims asserted by Mr. Tyler. After the verdict was rendered by the jury, Mr. Tyler made certain substantive challenges to the jury verdict in this case under 805.14 and 805.15. He challenged the sufficiency of the evidence and he requested a new trial based on errors in the trial, alleged errors in the trial. And after hearing an argument, the court denied his motion and requested that I draft I volunteered, if you look at the transcript, to draft the order. So if there's problems with the order, they're to blame. I'm the person to blame. But as you look at the order, you see that it's very detailed and addresses all of the substantive challenges that were made. The question is, under Harder, how does Harder apply to this order? And I would submit the following before I talk a little bit about what I think Harder stands for. One, we have an order in this case. That's what Harder requires, an order or a judgment.
It's labeled an order.
It's labeled an order, okay. Correct. Second, the order relates to substantive issues in this case, the challenges to the verdict. Third, the order disposes of the substantive issues in this case. It denied the motion. And fourth, after the order was entered, there were no remaining substantive issues to be resolved. And that's what Harder says. Look, does it dispose of all substantive issues? And moreover, to put it another way, after the order or judgment is entered, are there any remaining substantive issues to be resolved? And I ask myself that question here, and I can't think of any. What substantive issues remain to be resolved? And if you look at the judgment that was prepared after the order was signed, it's a one-line document, and it states, based upon the jury verdict, the claims of plaintiff are dismissed with prejudice. I would respectfully submit to the court that this document does not resolve any substantive issues. The substantive issues were resolved by and through the order denying post-trial motions.
Counsel, I want to ask you the same question that I asked your opposing counsel, since you are referencing the judgment signed June 4, 2005 by the court. As I indicated, a judgment is final, interlocutory, or partial under our case law and statutes. What is this judgment?
It's a final judgment.
So we're in a situation where a final judgment is not a final judgment.
Well, under Harder, you're in a situation where the document that disposes of all substantive issues is the document to be appealed from. And in this case, that the document is different than the judgment.
And I understand that. My question, and that's the right answer, certainly. It's the right answer, but I'm not sure it's the exact answer to my question. My question is, so under Harder, we are presented then with a final judgment, undisputed by both counsel, that this judgment signed by the court is a final judgment. And then I look at the statute, and what the statute, 803, is looking for, I mean, the first sentence, appeals of right, a final judgment may be appealed as a matter of right to the Court of Appeals unless otherwise expressly provided by law. So is our Harder decision otherwise expressly provided by law? I mean, the first sentence of 80803 says a final judgment or a final order of a circuit court may be appealed as a matter of right. Everyone agrees this is a final judgment. So what do we do with that first sentence? If it's a final judgment, but it can't be appealed.
It's a problem.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking about.
I don't have a good answer for you. You have what the statute says, and then you have arguably what Harder says if you strictly construe it. And that creates a conflict, and I concede that.
Counsel, let me follow up Justice Bradley's question, and I'll ask you the same question I asked opposing counsel. Given the fact, let's assume for sake of this question that we construe Harder in such a way so that that document that's labeled the order denying post-trial motions is contemplated as the last action in the case, and that is a, quote, final order in the case that would trigger appeal rights. Once again, given the wording of that order and given the lack of a judgment prior to June 14th, could opposing counsel or the other side have appealed the judgment as part of its notice of appeal? I'm keeping in mind the Homeowners Loan Corporation versus Papara case from 1940. You think so? My concern, and the reason I bring up the homeowner's case, is that that was a case that had a series of orders and judgments that were involved, and the court construed one of the final documents as being the final judgment or order, but ruled that the original judgment filed back in January of 1939 was of no effect because no judgment had been entered, and in fact the court dismissed the appeal with respect to the original judgment. And so I have some concerns because it seems that on our charter we've got a final order here, but I'm not sure that you can get to the judgment from that order. And if not, that, buttressing the question that Justice Bradley had, seems to run contrary to the statute, which provides an appeal of right from a final judgment.
I don't have a good answer to how to resolve that conflict. I know what Harder says, or I think it says, and Justice Bradley pointed out the point as to what the statute says, and that is a conflict. And I don't have a magic bullet to resolve that conflict.
In this case, how would you resolve it in the big picture as a lawgiver?
Well, in the big picture, I think, in my humble opinion, this court can issue decision after decision. I think this is an issue that needs to be addressed by the legislature. I think that the rules under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure are something that would provide clarity and would much more clarity and would address the issue and resolve the issue. And I am concerned that, you know, the court did a wonderful job, I think, of providing a bright line test. And that is, you look at the document and you say, are there any substantive issues that remain to be resolved? That's a simple question, at least on its face, that most practitioners can answer. But then we get into these catch-22 situations with your interpretation of the statute and the language of the statute. And I firmly believe, and this was in the amicus brief in the previous case, that this is a matter that the legislature has to address. There should be a separate document that is the judgment, and that is the document which needs to be appealed from.
Well, isn't this court obviously a co-equal branch, and we have comity. Couldn't they also suggest, and I was going to mention the amicus, they're suggesting that we come up with a rule. We invite in the bar, the public, and come up with a rule that would help everyone out because it is unclear. My question to you is why we're thinking about that, maybe not so much in this case, but it has been brought up about construing the order against the person who drafted it, if there's any question. Now, you drafted the order. Well, it's a fine order. I read it to opposing counsel. But the point is, if there is a question, and it seems to me in this case, first of all, you get an order, and then you get a judgment. And that is really a trap for the unwary. Which one do you... And it's hard, in my opinion, to decide which one to use. You say your argument is all substantive issues are in this. I don't really argue with that, except it's hard to understand and to sit here and say, well, all issues are taken care of. And the one that popped out and someone said, well, you don't worry about costs. Well, you don't. Okay. But you're then stuck with the case which you dismissed. I mean, the Steinman case going back 70 years. Well, before I was born, so it's over 70 years.
Well, my prospective answer to that is, in contract law, we have a principle of construction that you construe the document against the drafter. And prospectively, in my wearing my hat as a practitioner concerned about these rules, that's the rule I would apply if you're going to go that route. On the other hand, if we look at your decision in Harder, the court did talk about who has the onus of being careful, who has the burden of being overly concerned about these issues. And in that case, you said the person who is potentially aggrieved by the decision is going to need to appeal from it as the person who needs to be on notice and be cautious. So Harder, I think, is somewhat different than that issue of what should be done prospectively. But, I have to say, from a practitioner's point of view, it makes sense to say the person drafting the order ought to be the person who it's construed against.
Counselor, once the judge signs an order or a judgment, it isn't like a contract anymore. It's the judge's decision, correct? I'm a little uncomfortable construing it against you and implying that somehow it's still yours after a judge signs it.
As a practical matter, at least in our neck of the woods in northwestern Wisconsin, attorneys are typically asked to draft the orders.
They are here, too. I mean, I practiced for 16 years. I never saw a judge draft an order. We always drafted it, but it was not our order once it was signed. It may have been when the other side objected to the draft, which he usually had an opportunity to do, but once the court signs it, I think the court takes it on its own, and it becomes then a public document. So though I see what you're saying, I have to tell you I'm uncomfortable with that approach.
I understand that, and, that's a difficulty if you're not going to address it by the legislative route.
Well, maybe that's what we should do.
I mean, to me, that's the answer.
We've had a number of cases from the Division of Hearings and Appeals in administrative law. And when an ALJ renders a decision, right with the decision are notice of appeal rights.
Yep.
Stapled right there. Is that something like that possible among the trial courts and practicing counsel?
No, I think it probably is. I think that's done in small claims court. I think you could certainly have that type of notice and attach it and send it out. But I think the underlying issue is going to be, do they get it right in attaching it to the right document? I don't know that that solves the problem.
Because you had a notice of entry of judgment, which is a notice that your appeal time is running. In the prior case, they attached it to a memo decision. And how is that different from what we advised in Harder, namely that the document should say, this is the final document from which an appeal must be taken if you're going to appeal?
Well, I think in Harder that was suggestive language. You said
right.
This is the preferred practice.
Right.
We're talking about you saying in order to comply with the statute, in order to have a final order of judgment, here is what
require
you shall
it.
Do.
Require and I, that. Mm-hmm.
And I think, I'll offer you my suggestions for what they're worth if you're not going to go the legislative route. And I think there should be a statement that this is a final order. I think there should be dismissal language. And I should think there should be a statement that the order disposes of the entire matter in litigation.
Use the statutory language.
And you could say, in order to have an order or judgment that can be appealed from, you have to have this language in there. Now, you've certainly cautioned us, and I didn't put it in my order, but you could clearly say that this is what you have to have. Or you could attach the notice of appeal, like you said.
Counselor, have you ever filed a petition with this court for a rule change which eventually does become a statute?
No.
Do you know that people do and that they're announced in every month's bar bulletin when we are going to have a hearing on such a rule? And that one way of legislation is certainly available to the bar as well as the legislators? I would encourage you to look at some of the bar bulletins and some of the petitions that have been filed. It might be helpful to us all.
Of course, the court can bring on an order, a petition, too, on its own right.
I'm sorry, Judge.
I'm sorry. The court can draft its own petition and have an open hearing. We did that once, and then after we got comments back, we denied our own petition.
That's why we need the help.
But you had a lively discussion, I'm sure. So, as I said, I'm going to just circle back now, aside from the policy issues, just to to some of the arguments that, that Mr. Tyler made in his brief to fulfill my obligation as an advocate, which I must do. Number one, there is an argument that this case is factually different, and it is factually different. There is no doubt about it. And, in fact, it's factually different from most of the cases that have been decided on these issues, because most of those cases are in dispositive motions, motions for summary judgment or motions to dismiss. And so it is different. I would submit that the court's purpose in Harder, however, was not to get into a fact-specific rule, but to provide overall guidance and some type of bright-line test. I think this court contemplated that the test that you came up with, deciding the substantive issues in litigation, was a good test that would cover almost all situations. Well, we're here before you with two situations that perhaps don't neatly fit. But I would suggest that if we take a strict interpretation of Harder, the facts of the present case, the Riverbank case, are different doesn't matter. Second of all, there was an argument that we need to look at the judgment, or you should pay attention to the judgment. And I would just submit that under Harder, you don't look at subsequent events like the judgment. Your focus is on the document at issue, which is the order. And as I previously mentioned, the judgment in this case really didn't have any effect on substantive issues.
And you are asking us to overrule the Steinman case, right?
Yes.
Yeah, the Steinman case.
Yes. Based on the fact that it was decided well before the statutory rules that are currently applicable in terms of when an order or judgment is final for purposes of appeal.
Let me try another shot to give you an opportunity. Any suggestions on how to resolve the conflict? You were just saying that in Harder you don't look at any subsequent actions like a final judgment in this case, and how that conflicts with the first sentence of the statute. Any suggestions on how to resolve that? If not, that's fine, because it'll take me a long time to try to figure it out, so you may not be able to have it standing on your feet right there.
Off the top of my head, Judge, I'm sorry, I don't have a good answer to resolve that. But it's certainly an issue that needs to be resolved if you're going to proceed with Harder, where you say you don't look at the subsequent document and then you have a final judgment, especially in the context like this. Although I don't know that, you know, this type of context has come up to the court before. I don't know that if you face this issue of a post-trial order denying post-trial motions, like I said, it always comes up on the front end. So this is, I guess, a unique case for you to consider and try to reconcile. Finally, the third issue I wanted to bring up was just that Mr. Tyler's argument that the order lacked certain required language, and whether or not it's this case of an order denying post-trial motions or another case, in some context, the court has to address the issue of is language of dismissal required? Because in Harder, you had a different case because there was language of dismissal in that case. So in the Harder case, you said, well, we'll look at whether or not all substantive issues are resolved, but you didn't really get to the question of is magic language of dismissal required, because the language was there. That order was pretty clean and clear on point with language of dismissal, you know, the entire action, the entire record, and that issue was going to come up in the summary judgment context. If you have a summary judgment order, that issue is going to come up. What do you do if you don't have this language of dismissal? And the question is, can a court dispose of all substantive issues without using certain words or language? I would submit that the Harder holding does provide guidance because it talks about you're looking at the effect of the decision, not what words are used. And Harder didn't say you have to have these special words in your decision. And substantive issues are disposed of routinely by motions and corresponding orders. That's, aside from trial, that's how most substantive issues are resolved, by motions and the denial or granting of the motions. So that issue needs to be resolved. I would submit that under a strict reading of Harder, looking at the effect, you do not need specific language of dismissal. as is suggested by the respondent in this case. In summary, then, I'd just like to say, on its face, the holding of Harder is simple, straightforward, and easy to follow. It gives practitioners one question to ask, and that is, when we look at this order, are there any remaining substantive issues to be resolved? Well, that's a question I can answer, and I think that's a question that somebody brought up, the second-year associate. I think that's a question a second-year associate can answer, too. If it's a summary judgment decision, and that decision and summary judgment is requested on three claims and granted on all three claims, I think it's an easy answer there. In the case we have in front of you, the Riverbank case, there's nothing left to do. There are no substantive issues to be resolved. That's an easy question to answer. I think the problem we get into, as Justice Bradley brought out, is that issue of the statute and how does that comport with Harder, and I don't have a good answer for you on that one. But I will say that the position that's advocated by Mr. Tyler in this case would undoubtedly narrow the holding of Harder. And maybe that's what needs to be done, but it's going to narrow the holding of Harder because it's going to focus again on the words used, the language used in a particular document, rather than the effect of the document, which is what you went to in the Harder case. It's going to look at somewhat at labels, and it's going to look somewhat perhaps at subsequent actions, which is what you didn't want to look at in Harder. And I think if you require special language, unless you're crystal clear as to what that language is, you're going to result in more confusion than what you have under Harder. And in sum, I think if you require special language, you're changing and modifying Harder. Maybe that's what you need to do. Regardless of the decision today, I will take note of what the court said about petitions. I don't have any good answers for you. I gave you my suggestions wearing my hat as a concerned practitioner, and I thank you for listening to me today.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sullivan, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Addressing the question that we have in this case, that is motions after verdict. Let's think of this scenario. There's a trial, there's a verdict. There are motions after verdict filed. Judge never decides them. Under the statute, they are presumed to be denied after the passage of time. What is the, and let's say that there is no judgment entered as required by the statute. What is the document that is to be looked at for the purposes of starting the clock on appeal? It seems to me that the requirement of the statute to enter judgment isn't an accident. It's there for a purpose. That it is there to make clear that there is finality and that the case is dismissed or that judgment is entered on the verdict. And we really shouldn't gloss over that. And that is the kind of thing, having that language, having that document, whatever it is the kind of thing that will provide guidance to the practitioners. I
think back to the days when I was an appellate practitioner. I did appellate work for 9 years, and was often the appellant in a case. And I was always concerned with issues of when a judgment was final, when an order was final, because I didn't want my appeal time to run, because I didn't want to run into other problems down the road with this court. So I just think back that the way that I used to do it, and the way I think a lot of practitioners do it now, is if they're on the losing end of a case, and an order like this were to come in, they would run over the same day with two documents. They would have in hand a prepared judgment against them, and they would have in hand a notice of appeal from that judgment and the order. And that way, any questions would be answered because it would all be done then. And I listened to both cases this morning, and yeah, there's an argument, well, who should have done what, who should have prepared which order. The statute says the judge has to enter the judgment. But it seems to me that this could really be resolved by the parties with just a little diligence.
Well, certainly, if that's what you did, I'd take my hat off to you. I mean, as a practical matter, something like this comes in, everybody else has got other things going on as well, and I may not look at this order for a day or two or more, and wait, as was the case here, wait for that judgment to come, and then once it becomes clear that it's not coming, prepare it and file it, which is exactly what happened here. And I think that certainly your practice, as laudable as it is, I think as a practical matter, for many of the rest of us anyway, it's certainly commendable, and it's probably something that we should all do as a practical matter, that's maybe not going to happen.
But I guess my question, and it goes, because I don't remember the timeline, so you have to help me with this.
Right.
Obviously, when this order came out at some point, you realized that a judgment had to go in.
Correct.
Had a notice of appeal gone out at the same time that the judgment had been signed in this case, relating back to the order that was done earlier, would this have been a timely notice of appeal, even relating it back to the order? In other words, could have done both judgment and order?
Right. The judgment that was provided was 2 weeks after the order.
Right.
So certainly, if a notice of appeal, docketing statement, all of those kinds of things, statement on transcript, et cetera, had everything been ready and filed at the time, I mean, it certainly would have been within 90 days, have been within 45 days. There was no notice of entry in this case, so we had the full 90 days. So I think that the other thing, and
time is up, so one short sentence, counsel.
Well, I think that the purpose of the rules enunciated by the court, the legislature, is to provide guidance. It's not to be a trap, I think that is really the guiding principle, or ought to be the guiding principle for the decisions of the court and for the rules that are adopted. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Sullivan, and thank you, Mr. Reinhart, for your arguments today. You not only had to argue your own, but endure the arguments of a similar case. That completes our argument in 2005 AP 2336, Tyler versus the Riverbank. If the students will remain here, Justice Crooks will be out shortly. And anyone who wishes to stay may